Welcome to the Ether. Today is Wednesday, July 20th, 2022. Today on the Ether, part one of a two-part CeFi space using Cosmos yields effectively and other random stuff. Let's take a listen.
In terms of how they're using their various sort of DeFi yields and things, and we'll kind of chat about that mostly, I think, as far as crypto stuff.
Hello, CeFi. Hello.
Hey, what's up? What you doing?
Yeah, so I was asking, have you researched about Route and ThoughtChain? Like, what do you think? Who's better?
Well, I know a lot more about ThoughtChain than I do about Route, so I'll have to admit that. I didn't really go too deep into Route. ThoughtChain, I think the major piece of the puzzle there as far as ThoughtChain being effective is if you are a user of native proof of work assets. I think ThoughtChain has like a core use case by allowing you to connect your wallets, right? So that's so if you're a big Bitcoiner, if you are, you know, into using some of the other various proof of work chains, I think that's going to be your best bet in terms of moving from stablecoins to you know, unstable coins, and even now being able to move the, you know, back and forth through the Cosmos. If you're using ThoughtChain, Rango is pretty cool. Rango, it's kind of a routing protocol for, you know, moving from, say, for example, like Bitcoin to Atom or something like that. Or I'm sorry, actually, no, actually, it's more important for moving to chains that are not connected to ThoughtChain already. But you know, ThoughtChain is adding more and more chains. You're going to be able to kind of swap between lots of different things.
Okay, what do you think about the non-KYC on ThoughtChain? And Route has KYC, I hear.
Yeah, I saw some commentary regarding that. I think at the end of the day, if you are a decentralization advocate, I think you're going to support ThoughtChain because you're not interested in KYC. You're trying to be unbanked, and you're trying to do so without any sort of like concern from a, like, you know, a general concern from a regulatory perspective. You want to be able to go in and out of, you want to basically use ThoughtChain like you would use a traditional exchange, but you are don't want to have your information strewn about like you would in a centralized exchange. I think that's a core use case of ThoughtChain in my view. You add to that the possibility if ThoughtChain eventually develops sort of like some kind of native stable, which they were working on, which I think they put on hold because they were, because of like their, because of Terra's failure, you know, Chad and others have figured out that, okay, well, maybe their protocol won't work either. So they put that on hiatus. But in theory, your ability to get stable exposure without centralization risk is still a problem in the DeFi space. And I think it's still one of the more core broken things. So I think if you believe in a multi-chain future, things like Route, things like ThoughtChain matter. If you don't believe in a multi-chain future, if you believe like there, we won't need that because one or two players is going to win in this game. Like, for example, let's say Cosmos wins and you have like, you know, 500 Cosmos chains and no one's building shit on, you know, the Solana network, or no one's building anything on the Elrond network, then you don't need multi-chain, right? Like, if you look at how like Apple and Google have dominated the cell phone space or the smartphone space, like, you know, people aren't building anything for the Nokia phone anymore. No one gives a shit, right? So there is a strong possibility that many chains will actually just die to attrition. And a multi-chain future would, you know, ultimately end up being like two or three interoperable systems, like and maybe these systems become the bridging systems and the routing systems become obsolete because no one cares anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Like it'd be like converting an Apple file to a Google file to a Nokia file, and you know because there's no bridge that takes you directly from Apple to Nokia, right? Like the whole concept is sort of like stupid on its face.
So they're
I
going
think
to,
what will happen is
there'll
be winners and
AVAX,
losers.
Right?
What's that?
Yeah, they are going to integrate AVAX soon. So do you think in the next bull run, ThoughtChain can all-time high price? Do you see it coming or no?
Well, for starters, well, price action is a whole other story. And we can get into that in reference to yields, actually. So
yeah.
So let's think about this for a minute. So price action, first off, so Bitcoin and most of its price discovery has occurred during a largely money printing time period in world history. Mm-hmm. So inflation has been at a relatively, hit your mute if you would for a sec, because you're getting a lot of feedback. So inflation has been high, and basically there has been, you know, Fed money printing for the last 10 years. Most of Bitcoin's lifespan has been in that process. I would say the first few years of Bitcoin, nobody cared because the market was so small that macroeconomics had almost no relationship to, Bitcoin price action. And the longer and longer we go, the more correlated BTC becomes with everything else. So I think there is an element of it becoming just a straight up regular asset class. And ultimately that means that like price action is going to be affected by everything from inflation rates to interest rates and all the other like shenanigans in macroeconomics, and you're just basically stuck with some of the price action there. Are you going to have some coins and things go up higher in price quicker than Bitcoin? Possibly. Are you going to see things crash and burn and die? Well, we've seen plenty of that, so that would be a yes. So. In this whole process, I think BTC, in terms of store of value, where is it going? Are we going to see the kinds of leverage that we saw over the past 2 years to drive the price straight back up to, 70K? There does not appear to be a strong reason to believe that that's likely to happen, just because so many of the major leverage players have been wrecked, both at an institutional level and at an individual user level. So, I'm not even sure like this little relief rally even matters. What we don't know is whether BTC number one is going to go down to its mining price, which is closer to 10K, which is quite possible. And that just drags everything with it, right? So we're basically doing a Fib retest right now on the daily chart. And you'll see a lot of shorts get put in there. They'll get, they'll get squeezed a little bit, and then you'll see a spike like you just did. But then, is the market going to keep dragging? I would guess so. Even when economic conditions weren't this bad internationally, you saw like double and triple bottoms for Bitcoin before, mega reversals, right? So are we going to now drag into a double and triple bottom? So if bottom for Bitcoin is around $18,000, like let's assume that's even bottom. Are you going to see that hit again and again before people have confidence for it to go up? Remember, price discovery is a constant thing. The bottoms are the higher lows are important, and the higher highs are important over time. So we know the value of Bitcoin is somewhere between $4,000 and $70,000. Where it's going to like break out of that $70,000 peak again, it's going to need more users, more buyers, and basically data suggesting that small buyers of Bitcoin are increasing, meaning that the size of smaller wallets reaching one Bitcoin or above has been like sort of, steadily happening. So there's kind of a general gentle increase in hodlers over time. So with each bull market, you get a bunch of newbies. They all buy high. Maybe some of them sell low, and maybe some of them just hold forever. So there's a kind of phrase I use, there's a hodler born every day. And basically over time, price ought to go up. Now, from the perspective of like what I was going to talk about is like basically what to do with yields of things. So let's say you're a Cosmos Atom holder, as an example, or I don't know, pick your chain. You'll have your various interest rate. You'll have your fixed supply tokens like eGold with Elrond, or you'll have like infinitely inflationary tokens like Atom of Cosmos. you'll have varying, you know, kind of rates of inflation and rates of emissions. Each of those tokens, all the different types of DeFi coins, has different tokenomics or whatever you want to call them. For a while, I think, you know, if you use the word tokenomics, you're, you know, like considered some kind of like shyster or something, Ponzi-nomic shyster. But I mean, each coin has its own, like, you know, token counts, team tokens, and all the other elements that you think of. So what do you do with those different yields and the different projects? Do you like, do you, so let's say you bought Atom when it was like $30, right now it's like 10, right? So you're down, let's say, two thirds on your position. You're down like, you know, 66% or something like that. What could you do with that? Okay, one is you could actually sell the yield, even while it's low. Why might one do that? It's because then you can actually tax harvest off of those lows. So if you bought high, you're actually able to sell the yield low, because in usually in first out taxation, you know, the coins that you're selling, even though you acquired them fresh and they constitute new income, depending on your tax jurisdiction, you could basically sell them low, and that actually helps you like deduct off of future gains in theory, right? So you could keep your core position alive, and you could basically just sell your yields, which is what a lot of validators oftentimes do. They use the yields to sort of like fund their daily operations. So one argument can be made, hey, you got your, you know, bills to pay, you got your Netflix bill to pay or whatever the hell you have, and you're going to sell your yield to basically essentially dollar cost average out of your total coin position, and you're going to go and like, you know, use it for something, you know, so that you're sort of not only de-risking your position size, but you're also using it for something useful in theory, so that you can feel like your crypto is being used for something, right? So that's an option. What about sort of like buying more low then? Like, you know, is there a rationale for buying low? Sure. Obviously, you can get more of different things when they're going down, if you believe in a project. With inflationary coins, their price appreciation is always going to be curtailed at the tops. Their potential for major gains is going to be affected because all of that yield can be sold off, or you can even use the yield to actually short the original coin if you want to be really aggressive with your hedging. So high yield earning coins are going to have selling pressure as sort of a given. So, but you know, it's interesting that all of the coins tend to sort of rise in a bull market, even the inflationary ones. You know, Atom went from like, I think $5 or something like that up to like $50. You know, as an example, I think Elrond's e-gold went from something similar, like you know, under, you know, $20 to like something like $500. So these things can all pump in a bull market, even the ones that are sort of like transiently inflationary, even if they have fixed total supplies. People just sort of breathe and everything goes berserk, right? That's what happens, or people push them up with leverage. So, you know, the use of like leverage in these markets pushes coins up. So like what I'm thinking of doing is essentially, okay, so I bought more Atom, for example, at like $6. I had some Atom for a 10, I had it at 20. And now that it was back to six, I went and said, all right, cool, I'll get some at $6. So I got some, and you're able to get way more, obviously, coins at a much at a low price compared to when it's high. That's simple math. But also your yield really multiplies if you're able to sell your yield when you acquire it low, right? And you're able to sell it high. So for example, if Atom's yield right now is 19%, I believe it is, then if I bought like $10,000 worth of Atom at $6, and now Atom is at $10, not only is my yield 19%, but in US dollar terms, it's actually even more than that, right? Because the value of the coins themselves went up. So it's 19% of the new sum. So really my yield is probably sitting somewhere like, you know, 30% or something like that, which is very, very good, right? So that's how you think of inflationary coins. You really should buy them when, like, you know, the RSI of, you know, crypto, the on the daily chart is like in the total dumpster. It's in the absolute red. It's down in like the, you know, sub 20 range or something like that. And you know that the relative strength is super low, the downside risk is super low, And then you start sort of like reaccumulating. And, you know, even with a modest increase in price, if you buy low and price goes up, even a modest increase means that your yield in dollar terms or in stablecoin terms has really gone up, right? So what I've done is I've said, okay, all right, look, I'm going to take chunks of Atom that Atom in my case, just an example. I buy it really low. I plan to use it for like funding my kids, college education. I've talked about that before. And what I do is I take the yield and I can use the yield when it goes up to sort of like sell it into stable and then go buy what I need with it, whether it's pay for college or whatever. And that's kind of a way to sort of like boost the yield in a sense. Now, the opposite happens if you buy high and then the price of the coin goes down. You might have put in, like, let's say you put in $100,000 and you expected like a 15% yield, but now the price of the coin is only worth, you know, the value of your net worth is now down to, let's say, $20,000 because you bought at the very top at $50 Atom and now it's at 10, right? So your net worth dropped by 80%. Your yield is there in Atom terms, but the actual value of that yield has gone down. So like if you got to have to pay a bill with it, you're sort of screwed if you bought high and now you're trying to sell it low, unless you're trying to tax harvest for future future purposes. But so, you know, in other words, with these things, with inflationary coins, you should never sort of like go all in, number one. That's pretty much a given. You should keep your day job so that you have income coming in. And, you know, you should kind of like get these things over time if you're going to get them at all. And that way you're able to sort of like every month kind of add to what I consider my yield earning position. And by selling some of my Atom every month, you know, especially when I tend to do it when the price goes up a bit, clear some of it, you know, send it over to, you know, one of your exchanges, like I think Atom, Coinbase, and pretty much any exchange has Atom. You can sell it, move it into stable. And then like, if you're like on Coinbase, for example, you can just tie it to your debit card, which I think is like 4% cash back or something right now. And you basically, you know, pay for some phone bills or some garbage with it, right? So it's a good way to sort of use up some money. And I think de-risking by paying your bills makes sense. Like, so I think, you know, with my son's money, what I do is like, I look at it from the angle of like, okay, he's got a dorm room, he's got bills to pay, he's got some food to eat. And if I can invest enough in the crypto that is yield earning that, he can basically convert that at any given time to cash, you know, and since he's only 19, it's nice because his taxes are low and he can convert it on his account to cash at any point and buy whatever the hell he wants with it. He needs to pay for gas, needs to pay for groceries or whatever. What's nice about that and actually spending it is then he can report that he's making an income, because basically that's once you're earning an income, it affects your taxation in that like, losses can be deducted against it. But also if he can accumulate it under his name and I can, you know, gift it to him that way. So what happens is that now his sort of like the funds are coming in under his name, my taxes are don't get affected, and pretty much that he can do it on his taxation, which is basically nothing. It turns out he actually got some stimulus money or some garbage because he was making income off of his crypto I gave him. And he actually filed taxes, you know, just turbo taxed it. And next thing you know, he's, you know, able to, you know, not only get some extra money from that, but basically able to like just demonstrate he's already making an income from crypto activity. So he just puts down in his like profession as like crypto trader besides, you know, besides, besides being a college student or whatever. So, so there's some tricks that can be done as far as yield. I think other things you can do with your Cosmos-based yield, especially with Atom being relatively high at 19% right now, is you can basically take that yield and buy other stuff with it. Like, for example, you know, every month I kind of watch about a month worth. I'm like, okay, I've got pretty much a pretty good amount of Atom here. I'm going to buy some Stargaze tokens with it. So when Stargaze was, you know, kind of low, I use my yield to just convert it to Stargaze. Usually the alts will drop even more so. This, like, the smaller the market cap, the faster they'll drop. So relative to Atom, Stargaze got hit more in terms of price. So converting to my yields to Stargaze, while Atom did drop, Stargaze dropped even more. So actually the relative effect is I get plenty of Stargaze with it as an example. And I can go buy NFTs and shit later with it. So that's one example. Other things would be like, okay, I'm going to take my Atom, park it with a little bit of Osmosis, and I'm going to get a little higher yield, closer to like 30-something percent as a Atom Osmo LP. Now, the problem with LPs is on the downside, you're going to get beaten down. Why are you going to get beaten down? Because Osmosis, the coin, again, small market cap, high inflationary, is going to get the shit kicked out of it when the prices go down, right? So you need to be aware of that if you do LPs. But, you know, the yield is high enough, and I want to kind of have a little position, have some Osmo, participate in it, like have some governance capabilities. And I basically use my Osmosis tokens to like, you know, I just take the ones I get and I just stake them, because the ones I'm getting are with the Osmo Atom pool, which is only half exposed to Osmo, half to Atom. And the yield is actually making up for the price drop, because I think I bought an Atom Osmo LP when Atom was like at maybe $11 maybe. So I'm underwater on it a little bit, but the yield is coming in fast enough where it's actually catching up quickly, because Osmo's yield on that super stakings or super fluid staking LP is like something like close to 30%, I believe. So I could take my Osmo tokens. I could also just swap those for Atom and go sell those to pay the bills, because the yield is even higher. So, you know, there's different tactics you can use, or maybe save some of them as Osmo, sell some of them and pay the bills with them. So I think one thing to consider strongly is, if you are actually selling your yield to pay some bills, and this is like, again, not exactly financial advice, but, you know, pay your bills. If you pay some bills, what you'll start to realize is that, like, oh, wait a minute, like, what would be a good time to either just simply stake it at the stake my yields that I get? What would be a good time to maybe sell my yields to maybe optimize, like, to just, you know, solve, you know, selling and de-risking and then paying some bills? What might be some time to add, you know, convert to stable coin and maybe leave it sitting there? And then maybe consider getting some more only if the price goes down. So, you know, so there's different tactics that you could use, but I kind of like the Coinbase debit card system, because like, its yield sometimes on some of the coins can be up to 4% cash back when you buy stuff with them. And if they easily accept Atom for both sending and receiving with low fees. So, and the conversion of Atom to USDC to use on the debit card is relatively inexpensive. And they don't charge anything to convert USDC to fiat or fiat back to USDC, which is nice. I can easily get Atom off platform. Whereas if I try to convert to like USDC on Ethereum, it's just a ripoff, right? It's like, it doesn't make any sense, especially if you're doing small to moderate size transactions. Off-ramping through Circle is just a waste of money. So in other words, you have to think about that in your return on investment when you're using your yield. Like, if you're wasting it all in fees, that's a problem. So Atom is nice in this regard. I don't hold much in stable coins. What I do is I just have some in stable that I use in the debit card. I keep topping that off, going, okay, you know what? All right, whatever bills we need to pay, you just top this thing off. And if it looks like both the market is down and I have sufficient amount to pay the bills, then you can take some of the amount that's in that Coinbase in USDC, convert it to Atom if the price drops. Like, let's say Atom right now is like around 10 bucks. Let's say it drops to 6 again. Let's just make up a number. And if it drops again, I have that cash sitting there that I can use to pay the bills. Or if, you know, I get a good deal on Atom, I can just get more of it, send it back, send it to my wallet, and stake it for 19% yield. And if it goes up to $10 again, great. I can, you know, do the same thing, rinse and repeat. So trading the yield and doing this slowly, like over a period of months and months, and using it to actually pay for stuff, I think helps you mentally, in the sense that, like, you start treating this like real money, as opposed to like, you know, as opposed to simply speculating on its value. You think of it like a validator would think of it. Like, a validator has to pay its bills. They stake, they make money off transactions, and then they use some of it to pay those bills. And as a result, they have to be disciplined in terms of how they're going to use their money, because they know that they have to run their operations with it. So think of your use of your crypto as like a business. Use it for something useful. And I'd like to see more platforms actually accept things like fairly liquid coins like Atom, because that way you could maybe go to, say, a gift card company, and you could just convert it to a gift card direct, right? That saves you a little bit more money over time, because if you need some of that, you know, you need some, a Best Buy or Walmart or whatever, and you can just sort of like, you know, transfer direct to that, you know, you can gift that to a kid or whatever. And, you know, no one's going to notice one way or the other. It's perfectly legit. And you can basically, spend your money that way. So there's different tactics. Maybe some of the folks can hop on here and like share what kind of methods they use. If they spend their crypto, do they just simply invest it? Like, or what are you guys doing with it? But while the market's down, spending it actually can be a tax advantage, interestingly, versus just simply holding on to it. But at the same time, it could also be the best time to be restaking your rewards, right? So it depends on your goals and your endpoints and what kind of time horizons you're looking at. Tenmei, any other, like, what do you do? Any particular concepts or theories?
No, I don't get into the yield stuff right now.
What do you do with your crypto? Just look at it, or
I just invest. Before I lost a lot in Luna, I'm just trying to recover now with Rune.
I see. You don't stake your Rune and earn anything on it, leave it sitting in a wallet, or what do you do with it then?
I just let it stay on my wallet. Exchange, sorry.
Yeah, you know, so that has been proven to be dangerous on some exchanges as well, by the way. So that's always questionable. But the other thing too is, remember, if you have any tokens of any type that are inflationary and you are simply holding them and not staking them, I would suggest not owning those coins at all. Like any coin that is a staking coin that you're not staking, you're literally just letting the value dissipate over time, because other people are getting the staking yields and they're getting a larger part of the network. And me personally, like, if I'm going to not have my coin staked, whether it's Atom or anything else, I will just basically be planning on selling it in the near term. Otherwise, I stake it, because why wouldn't I want to make that? Like, there's no increased risk of staking on Cosmos, right? So, like, it makes sense to stake things if it's a staking coin and the yield is productive. I'm just talking about how you can just that yield to de-risk your position in a sense by using that as a way to like consistently sell. And that's a reasonable option, I think. But anybody else want to hop up, chat about this? Got some ideas, whatever. Certainly, like, with some of the US customers having their ass handed to them on Celsius, on Voyager, on, like, I don't know what exchanges got affected by their various lending and rehypothecation scenarios. There's quite a few people that either lost money, have their money locked up somewhere, or whatever. So there's the people that have their coins down in value 80%, and there's the people that have their coins stuck or lost on various exchanges. And I will reiterate that, like, when you leave your coins on an exchange, when there's FUD going around, let's say, for example, related to Celsius or related to Voyager or related to Coinbase or KuCoin, like, you won't know which FUD to believe and not believe, right? This is the problem. So then you're going to have your coins on some place. You're going to sit there going, I'm not sure what to do right now. You're going to see tweets that, you know, want you to panic. There are situations where you're supposed to panic, like, for example, when, you know, Voyager or Celsius or Terra or some other platform sort of like literally crashed, or Harmony One or other places who got their bridges hacked. At those times when you are like leaving coins in sort of higher risk destinations, you won't even realize that the risk is there. But even if something happens, you're not going to know whether to believe the FUD or not, right? What do you have, an inside track on KuCoin? Remember, like, a month ago, people were kind of like, you know, talking about how KuCoin, you know, might go under, and like spreading FUD, and it may or may not be substantiated. We still don't know. We have no idea what the financial health of some of these institutions are at a core level. We have no idea what kind of risks there are there. And, so it's not clear that holding them there has any more benefit. But I would say the Cosmos-based ecosystem chains, they have functioned correctly. Remember, like anything that we lost on investments on Terra had a lot more to do with financial risk, not so much chain risk predominantly, right? Like it wasn't like some of the bridge hacks or like, it wasn't like the chain was hacked or something like that, or a validator was hacked. This was more of a financial sort of decimation or attack or vector, as it were. But the chain was functioning appropriately. The halt to staking and all of those things just tells us that, well, we probably shouldn't be tying in the mechanism of the primary chain coin to certain like complex mechanisms like the Terra UST, which can wreck the governance token. But outside of that, the Cosmos chains, even the Terra chains, work correctly as intended. If the users or the people building on the chain do something weird or something that doesn't work, that's a risk that you're adding to the system that wasn't there by design, right? So this is part of the reason why Jay Kwan and others, they don't like the idea of messing with the Atom token too much. They're like, okay, you got your hub token. If you introduce all sorts of governance risks to the Atom token, if you introduce all sorts of other complications and mechanisms to it, that you have the possibility of breaking the chain somehow or introducing a exploit that's not known, and that could be bad for the system. That's why Jay does not like the idea of some kind of either permissioned or permissionless smart contracts opening on Cosmos. Having said that, like he's been working on kind of a Tendermint 2 and looking at GNO and other projects that are designed to kind of be the next level sort of stuff. But there is something to be said for like there comes a point where chains should not be modified. No further governance should take place. Like literally nothing happens. It just runs. And you can rely upon it running day after day after day. The staking mechanisms, the validation mechanisms work, and you try not to break them. Like your primary mission is not to mess around. And that's an argument that could be made. And I think you're going to have a lot of different variety on costs with respect to that, right? You're going to have things that have single use applications that don't change very much, and they do their job well, and they remain sort of immutable to a large extent. And then you're going to have chains on Cosmos that are constantly under development, almost like an operating system, and you're getting updates all the time and what have you, because it's believed that the tech of blockchain is incomplete still, and therefore things like governance need to continue to evolve, and governance mechanisms and all the other like technological shit that has to happen to make chains better. So you're going to have arguments for both immutability like a Bitcoin or constantly changing via governance and that sort of thing. That's the beauty of Cosmos, though. You can have chains that have all these different types of governance and whatnot. And it's kind of what I sort of like about Atom is that the newer changes that are happening to it, whether it's if interchain security or interchain accounts get implemented, it helps the rest of the Cosmos. But the goal is not to necessarily make the direct goal is not to just simply make Atom's price go up, right? That will happen as a result of people just using it and holding it for use in the Cosmos ecosystems. But its destiny is tied to the destiny of the Cosmos at large. Its destiny is not to become like an ultra smart chain platform of its own, because like, why would you need all the other Cosmos chains then, right? Like it doesn't make sense. So I'm kind of with Jay on that a little bit. I'm not so sure we need to mess with it too much, but if anyone wants to hop up, just kind of open mic the thing and just chill here. If you want to talk about stuff, whatever, it's all good with me. Just hanging out for the evening a little bit. Feel free to hop up, ask some questions, whatever. I can answer whatever I have answers to. there are so many Cosmos chains coming out and so many possible applications. Like, we just don't know. Like, it's hard to even keep up, honestly. I've get some requests to review some like new chains with some private passwords to sort of see what they do. A lot of interesting things happening. But the tricky thing with all these chains is, how are people going to find out what the hell that they do, right? Like, advertising becomes an issue, and getting users to understand what they're using and why they're using it is going to become harder and harder as more of the, as so many more options emerge. Mojo, what's up?
Hey, Seffy. Yeah. Thanks for hosting this. Good to see you back in the mix.
Yeah.
I guess just on the Atom and the interchain security, I think there's a lot of talk about, like, Atom doesn't have the value equivalent. I think you just sort of touched on that with interchain security, that I guess that'll bring maybe more liquidity and action on the chain. Is it your belief that there'll be a natural increase because, like, Atom then becomes the liquidity pair for a lot of the trading of these assets on these different chains? Like, how do you sort of see interchain security playing out in terms of Atom and increasing the usage of Atom?
Yeah, in some ways, I think Atom should take on principles of Bitcoin, being relatively immutable. You just don't mess with it too much. It serves as some core hub functions, and it facilitates the rest of the Cosmos. And if nobody buys it for speculative purposes, it's almost like, who gives a shit? Like maybe you shouldn't be investing in this thing. Maybe you should just only use it to use it, right? You get some, you use it where you're supposed to use it, and then you get rid of it, whatever. That's fine. And I think that's an acceptable possible future for it. I don't think that means it's going to, like, quote unquote, go to zero. Like, even with its inflation rate where it is, if you look at the average volume on Binance of Atom, and how much has been traded, it's been steadily increasing over the years. Like, so in up markets, down markets, there's a steady average volume rise, which is exciting. So whatever it's doing its job as it's intended, the same way sort of BTC does. As far as added value accrual mechanisms, interchain security seems to be the most obvious use of this, where, you know, you want a coin that's credibly neutral among all the Cosmos chains. And the idea is that you would be able to spin up a new chain using validators that are also already validating on other chains. And, you know, one validator could validate more than one chain. And Atom would be at the core of this sort of adventure, and it would create sort of a utility for the Atom token. The interchain accounts, the way I see it is, so if you have all of the IBC-enabled chains running, and they have IBC-enabled, all the Cosmos chains running IBC, you would be able to use Atom from your Atom wallet to make any transaction on any chain within the system. And furthermore, you could theoretically have, like, interchain liquidity of any of the IBC tokens. And I don't even know if a DEX is necessarily required for that final process to take place. Like, or maybe from the perspective of the user, you won't necessarily have to use a traditional DEX. Like, so if you have Atom, you could use it anywhere to buy anything, and shit will just get converted in the background. And, you know, it'll go from Atom to Juno or whatever, right? Like, so you may not need to hold these other coins necessarily. So, you know, and you may want to hold, say, more Atom because you like the governance properties of it, or you might like to hold more, let's say, Juno because you like the governance properties or the yield of the token properties of it. But you wouldn't necessarily, from a user perspective, be straddled with this stupid decisions of which coin to use where and how to figure it all out. Like, the end user does not give a shit about this stuff, right? Like, you go to Walmart and you want to buy some milk or whatever. Like, you just want to walk out of there with some milk, your wallet gets emptied of some money, and that's the end of it. Like, to be able to flip through bunches of coins and whatnot to get to the end product, I don't think that's the future of crypto. It's just asinine to a large extent. Like, it doesn't make any sense, and the public is not going to buy into that shit. So interchain accounts where like Atom becomes sort of like a general coin that can generically be used and exchanged anywhere, that's a really powerful thing. And it's going to lead to more liquidity to every chain, right? If you think like the best way to accrue value to the Juno token is by like listing Juno on exchanges and then like promoting that, like this whole thing is questionable, right? When you add, let's say, your individual chain tokens on decentralized exchanges, you get all sorts of shenanigans like, you know, longing and shorting and, you know, leverage trading and all that. And you definitely get more price velocity to your coin. But do you actually gain any more utility from doing all that? Probably not. Do you need infinite numbers of speculative tokens to leverage upon, you know, on centralized exchanges? No. If you look at like Coinbase, for example, like probably, you know, the top 20 coins have serious volume and all the rest of the coins just sit there doing nothing. So I think it's going to become a crowded market in the sort of like infinite altcoin market. And I don't think that's useful. I think it's, to me, more useful to have, say, for example, Atom is the core liquidity gateway. You buy some Atom wherever, you go play on Cosmos and you do all the other cool shit within it. And you don't have as much non-DeFi manipulation of the various coins, right? Like they, you know, like what happened to Terra UST is a great example. Like that whole stablecoin thing would have worked well on chain if you didn't try to create like expansion to centralized exchanges. So that those kinds of problems, I think, become less problematic when you stay within code and you stay on DEXs and such. And I think that's kind of how I'm seeing like where Atom sort of goes. I don't know if those things will materialize, by the way. So don't assume that they will or that they will be done correctly. Any number of problems could happen with either interchain security or interchain accounts. And that's all sort of still a pipe dream. But there's people thinking about it and interested in making things like that happen. It doesn't necessarily, even with Cosmos, Atom does not have to be the coin of interchain security, nor does it have to be the coin of interchain accounts. But it's the most reasonably credibly neutral, I would say, of all of the chains compared to, like, let's say a new chain coming out and trying to accomplish this. Maybe people like Axelar and others might attempt to be that for Cosmos, which is fine. But then you create additional centralization. I think things to promote the increased decentralization of Atom would be very, very helpful to the Cosmos ecosystem, as opposed to like relying only on central players for the primary liquidity layer, which I think, like, if you analyze the wreckage of Terra, like that essentially can happen to any chain for lots of different reasons. And then now all of a sudden all the crap that's built on it gets broken. And now you also break the liquidity layer to come into your ecosystem. Like UST was everywhere. It was really easy to get to Terra at the prime of its existence. It was working very, very smoothly when it was working, right? And that was really great. And if UST would have worked, then obviously it would have made a perfect sense to transact and go in and out of the ecosystem with UST. It was cheap, it was easy, it was lot smoother experience than USDC on Ethereum, which maybe after the merge, Ethereum becomes like maybe cheaper, nobody knows. But I think Cosmos can do better. And I think it can do so with if there's a credible sort of like push for increased decentralization, particularly for Cosmos Hub, for Atom, I would be a strong advocate of that if people would do it. Anyway, Bless Hammer, what's up? What's going on?
What's going on, bro? I'm wondering if anybody here has messed with the secret derivatives on Secret Swap, or what their thoughts or feelings might be on that stuff.
Well, for starters, what kind of things right now are you using Secret for? Like, do you like it for NFTs? Do you like it for like just the general privacy philosophy? What's your take on Secret to start with?
Well, I love the privacy aspect of it, but I'm super, I mean, I got NFTs and stuff like that, but I'm super stoked about the potential of derivatives and being able to swap those and how that all works. So I haven't really messed with it too much. I just was looking at it and looking at the, see how the pools work, but I didn't know if anybody else had messed with it or knew what else it can be you know,
like what
used for outside of that.
What types of derivatives do you like? Like, what do you want to see? You're talking about like staking derivatives. You're talking about like liquid staking. Are you talking about things like what specific type of derivatives you're interested in? Like leveraged products or what?
No, pulling in other tokens and being able to swap those as derivatives in secret swap.
So that way you can like have front running resistance on secret, but then you can be exposed to the price action of coins that you like.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then liquidity and all that kind of stuff too. So just to stay on the topic a little bit.
Yeah. Like I haven't heavily, there were a lot of projects that were happening that I was interested in on Terra in particular related to derivatives trading. Some of the most, and particularly as it pertains to robotic trading, where, you know, you automate systems to trade for you. And there's a couple of things in DeFi that I noticed were sort of problematic. One is the cost per transaction is still too high for that kind of volume. So what happens oftentimes in DeFi trading platforms is like you're upwards of 0.3% fee per trade, at plus or minus additional slippage on top of that. So that's not really that, it's not that great for the purpose of any frequent trading. If you look at like just overall benefits of just trading in general, I think the problem in crypto tends to be that outside of like stable coins, there's too much correlation between one coin versus the other. In other words, like when Atom goes up, Osmo goes up. When Osmo goes down, Atom goes down, right? So there's too much correlation between the DeFi coins to do a whole lot of serious like profiteering when it comes to trading without some substantial like strategic method that you seem to have. Like if you have like some alpha that something's going to do really well and you want to trade one thing for the other. But I don't know, trading as a major way to make money in like traditional crypto platforms, I think some people do it well. A lot of people end up doing it kind of poorly. Whether it's better on secret, like the technical difference on secret with, let's say, a DEX, would be that it would have like some front-running resistance. And therefore, if you're doing limit orders, so let's say you wanted to buy $1 million worth of secret token, and someone was able to front-run you and able to like front-run your limit order and like, you know, get it at a cheaper price than you because they could see your transactions come in before they could be executed, and they could front run your bots or whatever. So I think if you're doing like pretty substantial monetary amounts, and or you're doing robotic trading, then you would benefit from the front running resistance that secret the secret platform might offer, especially if they get to the point where they're doing order books. I am interested to see what DYDX does on Cosmos as far as their ability to do derivatives and whatnot. And especially from the perspective of order books, a lot of DeFi platforms have AMMs. They don't have order books. An order book would be something like Serum on Solana, or I think what DYDX is doing on Cosmos. I think DYDX gave up on the idea of order books on Ethereum. It just wasn't set up for it. Cosmos is just better for that sort of thing. I think Solana is better for that sort of thing, from my understanding of the tech. And that's kind of where that's going. But even DYDX, it may not have the benefits that Secret has as far as like front running resistance for large orders. But hopefully you understand what front running actually is. Front running is sort of like the idea that since you're on a public open blockchain, people can see your orders, and therefore, if they can see them, then, you know, they can basically put an order that shave off, you know, maybe pennies off of their order, and then make your order more expensive, or make you miss your order. But the they know you want to buy, so they can just sort of like front run you and then make it more expensive for you. And they can do this at a moment's notice, and they can do that like serially with like transaction after transaction, so that they're always getting a better deal than you, and do see these kinds of shenanigans. So that's kind of the one of the weaknesses of DeFi is front running. And that's what Secret, to my understanding, is able to sort of like solve that problem in theory, right? So that's the idea. Does that answer your question? But I have not used outside of playing around in Secret for a few minutes, like here and there, like I haven't really gone deep into it. There's probably people here that know way more about Secret than I do as far as like utility.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the main premises for sure, is the front running resistance or the, you know, the MEV, minor extractive value. Also getting exposure without even having to do it directly on chain. Like they have the ETH, the synthetic ETH, you know, Secret ETH or whatever. But I don't have to get into Ethereum to get exposure to Ethereum. Now I take my Secret, turn it to secret, and now I can get Secret ETH, and now I have exposure theoretically to Ethereum. And I think that's awesome because you can get a whole bunch of different, you know, other assets via that mechanism. So that's what I'm kind of excited about, by being able to get, you know, not just the, you know, on the back end, worrying about, you know, my trades and, you know, getting took for my fees or any of that, but having that value without even being exposed on that chain, I think is a really cool concept.
Yeah, one of the things that we've talked about extensively in the past is this idea of like also ETFs. Like, think about an exchange traded fund on the stock market. So you can basically put your money into an ETF, which would be like, for example, a solar fund, for example, because you like solar panel manufacturers, and you put in, you know, $10,000 into this ETF, and they are, you know, diversifying into lots and lots of different companies that produce solar shit, right? So you now have exposure to 100 companies, and maybe you only have like $100 worth of exposure to any one company. But one of the interesting things about an ETF is when the ETF reshuffles the deck and sells some of those assets and buys other ones, you don't have a taxable event in probably almost any country. Mutual funds, ETFs, reshuffling the background doesn't cost you any taxes, right? Why is it that if you take money to a DeFi wallet and you go and buy and sell shit in there, that now you're subject to taxes, but an ETF is not? The sort of legal or financial difference is if you are actively managing the money and there's a ledger that shows that you have bought and sold things, then you have tax liability, meaning the existence of tax liability happens because you can prove that a transaction happened, a buy and a sell, right? So on a public blockchain, every transaction you make, you know, if you buy some Atom, you sell some Atom, you buy it, you sell it, each one of those is a taxable event. And you're supposed to keep records and all of that. Otherwise, you can, you know, go to jail or be fined by the IRS or whoever your tax authority is. In DeFi, what's interesting is if you put your money into a vault, like even on a public blockchain, and that vault is doing some trading in the background for you, like whether it's robotic trading, whether it's like whatever, it's in a strategy of some kind. You only have to pay taxes when your money enters that vault and when that money exits that vault, right? So if you put $100 in and you made $100 and now it's worth $200, that $100 capital gain you would theoretically cover. And if millions of transactions happened inside that vault while you were, you know, asleep, you're not going to turn that million transactions into taxable events. It only goes based on when you put the money in the vault and when you exit, very similar to an ETF or a mutual fund in the, you know, stock market kind of sense, right? So on Secret, if you're in Secret, which is what he was talking about, you basically are in a position where any buys and sells that you make, there is no record officially that you have to release, and nobody can coerce that record from you. I would argue it is at that point not that different from an ETF or a mutual fund, because even if someone could claim, hey, you manage this money and you made a bunch of money from this, you can't prove and you can't forcibly, you can't force someone to relinquish their the secret data. And there's no way for them to tell how many transactions you made. So I would argue that the entire wallet becomes an ETF at that point, and only what would be taxable is what, you know, left the wallet compared to what entered the wallet. So if $1 million went into the wallet and 2 million comes out, well, now you have, like, you know, taxes to pay. So the governments of the world have not solved exactly what they're going to do about this type of situation, right? The when you talk about trades that are happening or robotic trading that's happening in a within a vault, like, you can't be held responsible, A, because you might not be able to prove what transactions actually transpired. Like, if I have an ETF, a solar ETF, and I buy it and I sell it, I have no fucking clue what's being sold in and out of that in that ETF. How am I going to be held responsible for that, right? And it's considered not being managed by you in that context. So technically, it's not taxable in that regard. You're only taxed on the full value of the ETF when you sell it, if there's a capital gain. So Secret, one of the interesting features of it is it sort of turns your whole wallet into an ETF. And I would argue that's what it is. In fact, unless someone can force me to relinquish the information within it, that is what it is. It would be no different than a DeFi vault that has the same data in it, but, like, you don't have access to it, right? So if someone can't prove in a court of law that you did anything because there's no record of it, well, then you didn't do it. It's as simple as that. It's innocent and proven guilty in most of the Western world. So Secret's an interesting sort of, like, philosophical and moral question as far as, like, what does this mean exactly from a trading perspective? So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting things when it comes to these trades. Like, if you trade on Coinbase, for example, and you buy and sell something, they don't consider Coinbase an ETF. They consider you actively buying and trading it as an individual, and you would be paying capital gains tax on each way. On Secret Swap, or whatever it's called, and you're in the secret system where, you know, none of that's, like, transparent to anybody, then you basically can do so without incurring any kind of data trail. So who's going to tax you for what exactly is not clear. Like, if you don't report it precisely, are they going to be able to force you to report it? No, because there is no, at least in the United States, there is no legal obligation for you to self-incriminate yourself, meaning someone cannot force you to unlock and provide your password to something if you don't want to. This is why, like, you know, some people with their Bitcoin keys, you know, hide these things or, you know, memorize them or whatever in order to like keep them out of prying eyes. People can't hack your brain in a courtroom or whatever. So that's not a thing. So this is kind of the idea behind some of the Secret network concepts. Now, you won't hear Tor speaking about this on, like, Secret Spaces or whatever. Like, this shit is not, like, that interesting for those people to do in public discussion, but realize that, like, a lot of the legal, regulatory, and other sort of advantages of something like Secret are not fully fleshed out. Is it possible that, like, public blockchains that are private by default could be outlawed, and therefore you even accessing such a thing could be outlawed at some point in the future? I suppose it's possible, right? It could be a Silk Road type situation. But if it's not possible to outlaw it, right? Like, if there's no way for someone to prevent you from using it or verifiably prove that you used it, then that's, you know, that's a thing. Now, that's kind of complicated, because if the primary gateway to, say, for example, Secret Network is Atom, because you got to get your Atom to Cosmos and then you got from Cosmos to your Secret Network, then they know you got there, sort of. And then the question is, okay, if legality comes in and they eventually make laws that say that, okay, well, Secret Network is, you know, illegal or something, then, you know, they can prove that you're actually entering and exiting it. And what could happen is you could create a community of people that just use Secret and never exit, I guess, which is a thing. Like, that's a definite possibility. A community develops. But if they're going to, like, exercise reprisals against you for having even used the damn thing, well, then you have another problem. So Secret's not entirely risk-free as far as a quote-unquote investment in that regard. There is some non-zero chance that that some sort of, like, regulatory bodies will have issue with it once it reaches a certain size, both in Europe and the United States. This is a distinct possibility. Currently, there are substantial sort of like anti-terrorism, anti-money laundering sort of interventions that are placed even on banks. So if you go to your bank and withdraw $10,000 cash, you immediately get flagged. If you withdraw $9,000 cash, you get flagged too, by the way, because they figure, well, you know, you're just picking 9,000 because, you know, it's not 10,000. So like these triggers are out there for those types of things in traditional finance. And there is no reason to believe that like these systems couldn't be used for ill will. So you can imagine at some point something bad will happen and then they'll track it back to something related to crypto. And next thing you know, you have like a whole new series of like legislation that happens. It's just, that's how these things work, right? Like there's not enough political will until something really bad happens. And all of a sudden legislators are all excited about doing something about it. It's sort of like, you know, TSA booths at the freaking airport. They weren't there before, right? Now your grandmother gets, you know, a full rectal exam at 90 years old, just make sure she doesn't have any missiles or whatever. So this is kind of comes late, but it happens after something bad happens, like 9/11 or whatever. Similarly, in crypto, we haven't had like our 9/11 type event. That will lead to some definite scrutiny of certain types of networks and certain types of activity. We do know that like Kraken, Coinbase, and a few others do have substantial reporting requirements now regarding users. Like if you try to apply to any of these things, you got pretty good amount of KYC you got to do in terms of like driver's license photographs and shit like that. So something to think about. But I think Secret Network is really, really important. I think as a project, it needs to happen. The more ways to get in and out of Secret Network, you know, without being recognized, I think are important for freedom in general. Obviously, any really, really free system that is obscured from regulatory interventions will have some bad actors on it and bad things will happen on it. Like if you don't think some, you know, pedophile network or some terrorist network wants to do nefarious shit with crypto, then you're delusional. Clearly they do. The question is like, how much of that is happening and how much of that will attract sort of attention, becomes a factor. And I think that's true. Like it's been talked about with Monero some, there's some question about how secret Monero really is. But with Secret, your reporting requirements are sort of up to you to some extent. You release what you want to have released, and Secret is private by default, to my, you know, the way I understand the technology. I don't know if there are any attack vectors for it to reveal your transactions somehow. And I don't know, I have to ask Tor about this, but I don't know if there's a way to coerce Tor. Like if I go to Tor at gunpoint and I want to know what Pusha's accounts have in them, is there some way to get that information by having someone in centralized development positions be able to like reveal information? I don't know. So like, that's the thing. Like, it would have to be secret. These things have to be secret enough that even people within development wouldn't be able to track it. Otherwise, those people could be subpoenaed and used as attack vectors against you if the time were to come about. So anyway, yeah, it sounds like, as much as I thought about this, it sounds like I'm a criminal. But like there are like pretty substantial philosophical issues at play here. And no, I don't advocate for, you know, terrorism or crime or anything else. Hopefully, you know, you create a universe that you have the least of that stuff happening as possible, obviously. To the extent that crypto can help that versus harm it, nobody really knows. But we do know bad things happen to good people. And, if you don't believe that, you've got like another layer of delusion. So I think we have to think about that. Secret's pretty cool stuff, though. I think the tech is really important. More power to them. Godspeed that hopefully they build cool stuff. The last spaces we were on with them, they had like talked about how they really made some improvements in speed and transaction speed and such. So it seems like innovation continues there. I think it's one of the bright lights actually of the Cosmos ecosystem in that it offers something very specific that all the other Cosmos chains don't necessarily offer, right? The key to the individual Cosmos-based projects is really to have a value add and a use case that none of the others have. So if DYDX can do something that all the others can't do, awesome. If Secret can do something, this is why I was kind of passionate about Terra for so long, because like the UST thing was, you know, a very specific use case, which I believe we still need in the greater sort of universe of like a relatively libertarian world where the only power to sort of like print money is not in the hands of, you know, a small cadre of, you know, government officials who can both simultaneously wreck the market or, you know, pick winners and losers. So I think in the name of freedom, I do think we need a Cosmos native stablecoin of some kind, which maintains stability within the Cosmos. I don't know if anyone's going to build that. I don't know if TFL is working on anything in that direction, you know, something very different from UST or whatever. I think it needs to happen though. I do think we need an internet native stablecoin that's sort of like stable within the nation of the Cosmos. If you think about Cosmos as a bunch of states, every chain being like a state in a country, you know, like my theory would be that like some sort of polychain, like polycollateralized system would be able to essentially create decentralized remittance across hundreds of chains via IBC. And that creates a sufficient decentralization and remittance system to essentially create a stablecoin within the Cosmos. It wouldn't be like one chain. It would basically be something that would be capable across Cosmos or Tendermint at large, and the entire system of all the validators, all the chains would basically create a stablecoin system. So I still think that's needed. The other thing that might be a consideration that's needed, and Shade Silk is working on it, is the idea of that maybe the stablecoins also need to be natively private, which in the course of this discussion, I think is relevant in that like not only is front running resistance a problem, but again, you want your wallet transactions to be concealed like an ETF or a mutual fund. You don't really want your conversions from stable to unstable being really read by everybody. I think that tech will come, and then governments of the world will simply have to sort of like respond to that and decide what universe we live in and then regulate accordingly. I don't think that the governments are going to be able to stop the tech from being produced. That's just like saying, oh, you know, we're going to stop electricity from being produced or something like that. It's just not going to happen. So I think the tech will come, and then like people start using these things, and then some sort of new, you know, 100 years, 200 years into the future, you have some new like regulatory or, you know, other regime that emerges from all of this. So anyway, that's kind of my thinking on like the future of like just privacy, I suppose. It is super relevant and needed. And how to implement it best, I think probably people here have some ideas. Anyone want to hop up? Just kind of like doing my little monologue here of some kind. if you come up, hang out, ask questions, talk about what you're doing on Cosmos, show some projects or whatever the hell you guys are doing, hop right on up and hang out. I see Jay there, and let's see, Polymath's here, and Pusha, and I don't know, Hank. If anyone wants to hop up and just chit-chat about what you're doing, go right ahead. I know that Near Protocol has mentioned that they're going to initiate IBC compatibility, which is exciting. I certainly want to see that happen because really the more chains that utilize IBC, the more successful Cosmos-related chains will be in liquidity terms. And really, it's just every chain that implements IBC, you know, reduces DeFi bridge risk, right? Bridge risks are part of our problem. You know, if you have an IBC and you have your coins, let's say you have your Near tokens and they're sitting on Juno or something, then, you know, so long as Juno and Near both exist, your coins are essentially fine, right? That's the idea behind IBC. If one of the chains goes down for some reason, well, you're basically screwed, and it creates a confusion in terms of what happens to those coins. You know, are IBC tokens that are stuck on some chain, or if a chain dies for some reason, someone blows up the chain or there's a problem, what happens to the value of those NEAR tokens? Do they wind up, you know, going to oblivion? Do they get censored? Like, what happens to them? I guess they may just disappear. But that's the core risk of IBC, is if you have this interchain and that chain were to die for some reason. So I think IBC is more useful short run for the short-term transactions without bridge risk. It doesn't mean that you should keep all of your crap on an IBC coin long run. But, you know, as long as your chain that you're dealing with is pretty secure, you feel like it's going to survive, that's sort of a risk you take, I guess. Like if you're a liquidity provider on with IBC based assets and such. So that should be interesting. It would also mean that IBC assets, Cosmos assets, would be able to go to NEAR, and people on NEAR protocol could buy and sell them. But here's the thing, like, once you realize what IBC is, whether you're NEAR protocol or anybody else, why wouldn't you just use Cosmos based chain at that point? Because, like, it's not really clear that like NEAR has a definitive use case above Cosmosm chains at this point, or for that matter, Elrond network, or for that matter, a variety of networks. There are some networks that are appreciably different than Cosmos-based chains, and maybe sharding networks and such, there is like, they'll have their own use. But it's not fully clear to me that we need a whole lot of non-app specific layer ones. The argument for layer ones is composability. The arguments against them is like centralization risk scaling risks essentially over the long run. So I think Cosmos solves a lot of that. It's sort of exciting to see like how far Cosmos has come after all these years. Pretty cool stuff. If folks want to hop up and chill, can do that. Can talk about whatever you guys want, but that's what I was saying. Like lately, I've been just trying to find ways to port over my Atom yields to like do interesting things like pay the bills and stuff like that. Sort of use more and more of my crypto for daily activities and such. And certainly less impressed with centralized platforms with the downfall of Celsius, of Voyager, and God knows who else. If anything, those things really just ushered in the new age of Cosmos, if anything, because so far, Cosmos-based chains have not had problems with hack risks and other problems. As long as you secure your seed phrases and make sure that you keep your materials safe, like Cosmos wallets work really, really well. Pretty happy with them for the most part, whether it's, you know, Cosmos Station or whether it's Kepler or whatever. If no one has any particular comments, we can kind of hop off. If anyone wants to just BS up here about whatever, go right ahead. Or I'm not sure if anyone's buying anything new lately or what you're doing. I'm kind of waiting personally, price action wise, for, I think in a market this nasty as far as global markets, I think it's reasonable to expect a double or even triple bottom in crypto. I think, these little leveraged moves where people periodically like push up the price can be short-lived. So I'm not really jumping into buying too much. It'll probably be the wrong thing. I'll say that now, and then Bitcoin will go to 100,000. It's always what happens. It'll do the opposite of whatever I say, so just be aware of that. I think usually in really, really bearish times, you tend to get more aggressive retests of prior bottoms. Where perpetual deleveraging events have to happen. And then, recurrent deleveraging events have to happen before people get really comfortable with buying a lot of spot coin. So I think I'm in that position. I think if we see, like Atom is a good example, it's at like 10 bucks or so. If it's down again at around $5 to $6 and it kind of holds there, I think that's a great time for me to grab some more, which is what I'm going to do. And then, kind of ride that up and then kind of clear some of the yield as it's the value of the yield goes up. And that way I sort of amplify the value of my yield while also buying at sort of extreme lows. And I do admit to buying some Atom at 20, at 10, and at as low as like six-ish recently. So I think my Atom position is probably on average somewhere like $12, I believe, is my average, something like that. So not doing too bad there. But I did not sell my Atom at the top or whatever you want to call it. Like, I'm not, like, I was looking at it more of a investment and, you know, and maintaining it for some governance properties, for some yield properties. And when I first got my Atom, I think it was at like maybe $12 to $15. The yield was like around 10 or 11%. Right now it's like 19. So what parameters are driving up its the yield so high? I think it's because the relative number of stakers might be low, but the inflation rate right now is fairly high. So just bear that in mind. But I'm just making use of that inflation rate. I'm like, all right, cool. I'll just spend that inflation and de-risk that way. Anyway, Dave is on here. Dave, you there?
Yeah. Hey.
What's up?
Hey.
Or actually, developer.
Developer, like, yeah.
I can see Dave on your speaker thing. Yeah. So
I mean,
like,
Dave is also good.
All right, cool.
How you been? You been good?
Good, man. Good, good. What you been up to?
Nothing much. I didn't catch the beginning of the space, but I got the most of the last parts. I was just curious. I started to think about, is there any metaverse project on Cosmos? No?
Let me think. There is that game called Strange Clans. As far as like, it sort of depends nowadays what you mean by metaverse. If we're talking about like a Ready Player One sort of video game environment, that's one thing. If it's I don't think there's any mega project, like, for example, a sandbox or a, what do you call it? Not Minecraft, like, what's the name of the other one? Decentraland type project. Yeah, I don't believe there's something like that happening on Cosmos yet. There were some happening on Terra before the crash, like Terra World and some others. So there are definitely developers who are hard at work on making those kind of environments. I don't know. I haven't talked to the people of Terra World as of late or any of those guys. There were several projects that were building sort of like 3D universes. I think those folks could port over to other platforms if their development teams are financially stable. And but I haven't really heard much from those teams. It's tricky too. Like some of those teams might just sort of like just disappear into the ether and then build a brand new project, or at least name it completely differently. Because some of those projects were vaporware anyway; they hadn't been released yet. Like Terra World is a good example. And I think what might have happened there is, like, let's say you're a Terra World developer, and you know people bought the TWD token. Or whatever, and they were hoping it would go up in value and they could use it to buy lands. In fact, they were selling like little lands and metaverse property and shit like that. And then, of course, like Terra got wrecked. And of course, when the ecosystem gets wrecked, you know, a lot of the users disappear and they're, you know, the project itself, the tokens crash in value. If you were that project, would you try to somehow, like, there's no way for them to just bring back value to the token. So whatever you lost in that, if you were a holder, you got kind of screwed. And there's no way for them to legitimately get that value back. They could airdrop some tokens to people if they're going to start a new project. But then the question is, do they have enough reason to do that and dilute themselves again when they themselves got wrecked, including their owners of their coins? So, I'm more bearish about. So after watching how Terra fired, I am more bearish about these environments and their connectedness to other systems that, if broken, like, they're also broken, right? Like, so the layer ones present some centralization risk to these types of projects. Watching layer one, like Terra, play out, it wasn't so much the UST mechanism that makes me bearish about certain things. It's more the governance mechanism and the wreckage of the sub projects that were on that blockchain. It's almost like, let's say, for example, you have a bunch of malls in your country, like, and they're run by a mall company, and there's some retail outlets that, you know, like Starbucks or something goes and puts all their shops in those malls. And now, like, the success of Starbucks is tied to the success of that mall, which can be good. Like, the mall can make money if Starbucks brings in anchor customers, or anchor tenants can bring in customers. But the problem is, if the mall goes to zero and closes, well, then Starbucks is fucked, right? They just have to close it down. So if you look at what Starbucks does, the perfect example, they don't spend that much on their small retail locations anymore. Like, you know, you're like, the original Starbucks in Seattle or whatever, wherever it is, and it's like, oh my god, look how, like, you know, interesting and cool this place is. And you go to some, like, really big cities where Starbucks owns maybe some of the property, and that's their, like, own property, it looks amazing. And then you go to, like, the ghetto Starbuckses, you know, around the country, and they're, like, renting from somebody, and they don't want to invest too much money just in case something happens to that, like, site, right? So this is kind of a layer one problem. If you invest in a layer one, that layer one, either through governance or politics or some garbage, things don't go well and development's not progressing, then you essentially tie the risk of your project to the risk of that, you know, whatever shit happens on the L1. So I think that has led to some of the projects that left Terra to decide to either move to a project where they believe composability matters, or liquidity matters, and there's existing users, and they'll go to, like, the super, you know, like the mall, like, you know, Juno or something, where it's like a, you know, permissionless smart contract platform, or they'll go and build their own chain, like what Kujira is doing. They feel like, okay, we have enough interesting activities that, like, are multi-chain, you know, future related. We don't have a lot of composability needs. What we do need to do is interact with lots of other chains. So Kujira making their own chain, if they're capable of doing it and executing, it makes a lot of sense, right? So the Cosmos, like, metaverse situation, which is kind of gets back to what you were asking, if you think about, like, the DeFi / NFT universe already as a type of metaverse, right? Here we are, like, spending the day talking about this shit, right? So, like, clearly we're spending enough time messing with this stuff that we're in our head, we're already in it. You know, a metaverse in a sense, like, sort of like you're in a metaverse on your social media platforms, you're on a metaverse when you go to a movie, you know, any non, like, you know, routine activity that you do behind digital or, like, replicated circumstances, you're in kind of, like, quote unquote metaverse, whether you're going to, like, a play at Broadway or whatever, it doesn't matter. Point is, you're sort of like in this, like, this sort of, like, non-real, but actually real to your brain sort of experiences. And if you talk about, like, is there a major metaverse project coming? I think first and foremost, it helps to have a lot of DeFi based projects available. I think it helps to have more governance based projects succeed, like DAO and these other things that are happening with governance. And you build these systems so that, like, when someone then finally wants to build a metaverse, they have the governance pieces necessary. They have the DEXs necessary. They have maybe some investment vehicles necessary. So that, like, let's say you are in a metaverse like Star Atlas, and you have a spaceship that your guild buys, right? Like, your guild buys a massive spaceship. You spend $1 million on this thing, like literally actual $1 million of worth for the spaceship. You load it with guns and, like, you know, I guess place for everyone to live and whatever happens in a Star Atlas spaceship. And you invest in that as a team, but then you also need to invest in sort of like some DeFi protocols and stuff. Cause as we all know, play to earn is a scam. You're not going to be able to just print tokens to infinity. You have to eventually generate, like, you might have to pay people to work and all the other kind of interesting things that happen in a metaverse environment. And for that to work, you might have to have, like, DeFi investment protocols that are more than just Ponzi schemes, because you don't want your video game world or metaverse world to just fall apart in some, like, you know, Ponzi fiasco, which is really what happened to Axie Infinity, right? Like, that's like, so in other words, the first question is, do you even want a metaverse to show up on Cosmos? And if one does, what kind of infrastructure needs to be present for that to succeed in a meaningful way? And I don't know if I have the answer to that, but it's a ways away. I mean, if you think about it, like, even in gaming, right? Think about some of the best gaming franchises, whether it's like for MMOs, like World of Warcraft, or in the past, like EverQuest and RuneScape, and some of the more powerful ones that have, like, persisted in people's minds and have stayed popular. So many of those types of, like, quote unquote metaverses, they succeed because they're fun. They succeed because their economies remain interesting. The game aspect of it remains interesting for people, the strategy or whatever engages them. The entertainment value keeps them. And maybe they're addicted to some of the financial aspects and gambling or whatever in those games. But like for that to translate to anything more than a video game, which, by the way, we already have in the 2 Web 1 world, you have to ask yourself, like, what can DeFi, what can NFTs add to this mix? They can add something, but they don't make neither of those things necessarily make the game automatically better. Like if I took an old game like World of Warcraft or EverQuest or some shit, right? I used to sell video game assets and these things for crazy sums of money on eBay or whatever. Like, I still can't envision fully how I would rebuild World of Warcraft or EverQuest to, like, incorporate, say, NFTs and crypto to automatically make the game more fun, right? Like, it just doesn't do that. You would have to build games specifically that take advantages of the unique features of crypto, the unique features of DeFi, the unique features of, like, NFTs, and somehow a new game emerges that is compelling for people to play. It's fun. And somehow or another, people are making money, creators are making money, transactions are making money, the validators are making money. Because if people aren't actually creating something for other people to consume, no actual value is being created, right? And entertainment is value, by the way. As long as you're creating something for somebody and someone's willing to pay for it in actual cash, and you can live off that shit, like you can go buy your groceries and whatnot, then that's a real economy, right? Like, and the metaverse concept, I think, has a ways to go. And I think there's reasons why companies like Steam and others, people at Blizzard, before their sex scandal fiasco. Like, I knew one of the founders of Blizzard. He used to play EverQuest with me in Fires of Heaven. Anyway, long story short, like, the gaming systems, like, they have been thinking about fun economies that are compelling for the better part of 20 plus years now, right? Like, I was in EQ selling shit on eBay in, like, 2000, 1999, right? Ultima Online before that. Of course, eBay just sort of emerged with gaming assets where people were selling them. That was a fad that started like 1999. That'd be kind of like the beginning of like serious like video game digital asset selling. Broadband came about like late 90s. And then right after that, like, we were selling shit on eBay and whatnot. That was kind of a big historical moment. But like since then, like, you know, you go on, it's like 20 years have gone by. And nothing has really changed in video game economies to any serious level where you're like, oh yeah, like, I'm gonna play this forever. Like my Fallout Vault Boy image on my graphics is because I like Fallout, and Fallout does a cool job making video games, but you'll notice that their economy starts over with every game. You don't transfer your weapons, you don't transfer your caps or whatever your money in the game, because if you did that, it breaks the game. They can't figure out how to make a good game without recycling the game from zero, right? Like, the whole point in video games is to reset your shit to zero and start over, and that's the fun, right? It starts, like, the progression is part of the fun. And none of these games has been able to solve that problem. World of Warcraft, if you guys have played that, it's been out a long time now. How do they deal with their how do they keep people coming into the game? They keep people coming into the game by basically new expansions with some new content, new dragons and shit, new weapons. It's just another version of, it's like a different pixelated version of the previous weapon, except that the stats are higher, and now the dragon has higher stats, and you're just in this grind to, like, you know, up your stats and shit. But, like, is it dramatically better to where you'll do this forever? Probably not. In World of Warcraft, they call that, or it's called mudflation in video games, where essentially you continue to inflate away the value of previous items, equipment, experiences, and dragons to where, like, if you go play World of Warcraft today and you go to some of the early levels, like, you can spend 5 minutes at the higher levels, load up your character with equipment that can basically slaughter all the bosses from the first five, you know, years of the game, right? That's what mudflation does. It basically makes the weapons and everything else obsolete so that you keep playing, right? This problem has not been solved in video games, and I don't think it will be. I don't think NFTs solve these problems. I don't think crypto solves this problem. It's a video game native problem. And I think that's why Steam, if you really get them into a room and dig in, why aren't you doing NFTs and crypto and all this shit? It's because none of this shit solves that problem. And I've been at this a long time. if there was a way to make a gajillion dollars making a video game with all NFTs and crypto, I'd be talking about it right now. But that's not that easy to build. And video game designers, if you do video game design or play a lot of games, you'll realize it's not that easy, right? Like what we used to do is exploit the shit out of every video game we could find, right? That's what we did for a living. Like, you know, we were not for a living, but, you know, like we were good at that. And the developers used to watch us and then, like, you know, change EverQuest and World of Warcraft based on how we played because we had to fuck everything up. And they would just like go and clean up the game. And then by the time everyone else used it, like, oh, okay, the game mechanics have been fixed. So game economies and how to exploit them is part of like the process. And with one thing that I think some of you guys, I don't know if you know, what's his name? Jimmy comes on here and he's really, really harsh sometimes. Like, but he's a game developer and he and I agree with a lot. He's kind of harsh, so people don't like his like demeanor sometimes, but he's right about a lot of things. And one of the things he's right about is that with video game design, if you get something wrong, right? Like think about NFTs and crypto. Like what is the benefit of these things? It's that they're immutable, right? Like your NFTs, once you have one, the information, the image, it doesn't change. The problem in a video game is, and this is true of Diablo, it's true of World of Warcraft and all these types of games that have been out there in terms of MMOs, and it doesn't matter which MMO, all of them have the same problem, is that the developers will always get some things wrong. They'll get the weapons wrong. Like all the Shadow Knights are bitching that their sword is way too weak compared to the warrior sword. And like, you know, and then the priest guild is bitching because they don't have enough DPS. And then, you know, like the ranger guild is bitching because, you know, they don't have as much healing as the priest guild. And the priest guild's bitching because rangers got too much healing power. And, you know, like, you know, we're a healing class. We're supposed to be the best at it. You guys know what I'm talking about with video games. Like if you've been in MMOs and you've seen the politics, what you find is that like most MMOs and metaverse type ideas are a work in progress, right? The real world is a work in progress, right? Like governments have regulations. All that shit has to change when smartphones get invented. Right. You know, then they have different regulations for telephones and then smartphones get invented. They had different regulations before computers got invented. Then you have to have a whole new world. Right. So the metaverse is sort of like an ever changing idea. And you never get like some version of it that's perfect. It has to be fluid. It has to kind of be able to evolve. It has to like speak to the users in that, like, as time goes on, the users want to keep on playing this shit, right? Eventually, even your favorite video games, you get bored of that shit and you're like, okay, I'm going to go do something else, right? It's time to go to Olive Garden to get some free salad or whatever. You want to do something different after a period of time because you're just bored of that. And the gaming scenario, I don't know, like, I don't find that NFTs or which is basically like a different way of storing data, right? An immutable form of data storage. I don't think it solves all problems within video games. It may solve some of them, though. The decentralized marketplaces and such are nice because what happened to us is eBay got shut down. I think like eBay shut down video game account sales, like I think in 2001 or 2002, I forget what, which. I made a bunch of money and I sold my shit, bought a cool stereo for my dorm room or my apartment. I'm sorry. Made some good money as a kid doing this. But afterwards, eBay shut it down because gamers were complaining that, hey, like real world money was being used to buy cool stuff. And so people were like farming the equipment and selling on eBay and using up all the nice video game locations. Because like in MMOs, like people would go and like, oh, this sword gets a lot of money in eBay. So everyone would go farm that thing and be a real crowded game environment in that area because everyone's trying to get the same thing. So monetary incentives create monetary problems. They create monetary strife. They create political strife. And if that's part of the game, like if the whole concept is, you know what, you're going in here, you're going to get killed, you're going to lose money. And like, this is part of the game. I think those games are popular. Like people that want to enter that strife and they want to have like a simulation that like has all that real world shit in it, but in a video game environment. A lot of people like that. But other people get really, really upset about it. They just want to have a casual video game. And Griefer over here killed me while I was like farming for gold or whatever. And, you know, sitting on my lonesome, right? Like, you know, I'm talking about Dave, like you play video games and some asshole comes and kills you and all you were just minding your own business.
Thanks for checking out another episode of The Ether. That was part one of a two-part CeFi space using Cosmos yields effectively and other random stuff. Recorded on Wednesday, July 20th, 2022. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening.
In the darkest of times, when the phoenix arises out of the ashes like some burned up papyrus, open the sarcophagus and release the virus. Got a lump in your throat like tonsillitis. When the flags go up like everyone is righteous, spending government checks, sniffing up the white dust. The previous generation wants to be just like us. Fuck that shit, I'm trying to be like Mike was. Drop the bias and you might survive this. The mummy coming through to remind your highness. I might just buy up my own fucking island, build a little bunker, then wait for the timer. Countdown to zero, day exploiting every exploit in your internet sex toys and emitting vibrations through the ether. Did you just come? Me either. If you look at the bright side, we're lost at the right time, blindly following stars in the night sky. Part of me might ride away with the prize fight, man versus everything else until the time's right. Unleash the Kraken, no wait, that was crack. Fuck, now everybody feeling all amped up, fucking like bunnies to the national anthem. Ugly little shits eating up all our rhythm, mishandling the captions, who has the answer, holding our attention for ransom. Fed up with all the red tape and the boring template, like it matters if it's a blue or red state. Charged every month and we can't even cancel. Feeling distressed? Fuck it, kill the damsel. Fuck yeah, spread it like we're on some undead shit and pass the bitch around like a meme from Reddit.
In the beginning, it was suggested that the mortality rate would be 5% and the numbers are so much higher.
We're not ready for the next epidemic.
And so if your oxygen level falls too low and it cannot be kept up with just what we call nasal cannulas or rebreathing oxygen masks, if you can't get enough oxygen from that, then they will intubate the patient.
Terra Spaces.